study classes, we kind of got to a point where we were going to have a look at Nagarjuna, and a few people had requested it and so on, and then we decided at the last minute that we didn't have really time, so we do it this year. So finally, after 2.5 months, which we consider as the preparation for Nagarjuna, we're now hitting the big boy himself, and we've learnt in the last several weeks. We've had a look at the emergence of Mahayana philosophy, and particularly the Prajna Paramita and the Heart Sutra, which is the summary of the Prajna Paramita doctrine. And in particular, there we've heard a little bit about their critique of the Abhidhamma concept of the Swabhava. And in a way, it's extraordinary how much of the Buddhist philosophy from this period, this is the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries, revolves around this particular issue. Later on, after Nagarjuna, it seems that the Swabhava doctrine had been so roundly discredited that they moved on to other topics, although perhaps also they simply got weary of debating it. So anyway, for this week's lesson, I'd like to have a little bit of a look at, as usual, just a little bit of background and historical context for Nagarjuna, and then plunging right into the text. Okay. So just reading the basic background here from Wikipedia. Acharya Nagarjuna was an Indian philosopher who founded the Madhyamaka school of Mahayana Buddhism. And a number of qualifications need to be put in there right away with the first sentence. First one is that the dates here are given 150 to 250 CE. If anybody's interested, I have a densely argued paper by a Melbourne academic who argues that we don't actually know Nagarjuna's dates to within 300 to 400 years. Okay. Sorry? Oh, it's just Tibetan. And there was also a question whether he founded the Madhyamaka school is not really attested as far as I know. He's certainly the major philosopher of the Madhyamaka. Another question is whether Madhyamaka itself is, and whether Nagarjuna was a Mahayanist, which we'll have a look at a bit later on. His writings are the basis for the formation of the Madhyamaka school, which was transmitted to China under the name of the Three Treaties School, Sanlun. He is credited with developing the philosophy of the Prajnaparamita Sutras and was closely associated with the Buddhist University of Nalanda. I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's very likely that Nagarjuna's association with Nalanda is entirely legendary. As far as I understand, it's likely that Nagarjuna had died before there ever was a university of Nalanda, but given the uncertainty of the dates, it's probably wise to be a bit cautious with that. In the Jodo Shinshu branch of Buddhism, he's considered the first patriarch. Little is known about the actual life of the historical Nagarjuna. The two most extensive biographies of Nagarjuna, one in Chinese and the other in Tibetan, were written many centuries after his life and incorporate material seen by some as historically unreliable. Nagarjuna was born a Brahmin, which again I would take as being pure speculation, which in his time connoted religious allegiance to the Vedas, probably into an upper caste Brahmin family, and probably in the southern Andhra region of India. That seems to be a little bit more historically attested, and it does seem to be closely associated with the Andhra region, which raises a few interesting questions. He apparently lived and taught in the monasteries, Mahasanghika monasteries in Andhra Pradesh, which is the same town where the Theravadan school, Sri Lankan Theravadan school, had a major branch monastery there as well. So interesting why there's no more awareness of, so little awareness of Nagarjuna within the Theravadan school. Very few details on the life of Nagarjuna are known, although many legends exist. He was born in southern India near the town of Nagarjuna Konda in present-day Nagarjuna Sagar in the Guntur district of Andhra Pradesh, probably. And again, this is a lot of this is arguing back from the place names and so on. According to traditional biographers and historians such as Kumara Jiva, he was born into a Brahmin family, later converted to Buddhism, this blah, blah, blah. He was one of the early significant Buddhist thinkers to write in classical Sanskrit rather than Pali or Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. Yeah, that's probably true. Although, whether that was because he was born a Brahmin, or I think probably more because of the general historical tendencies at the time. From studying his writings, it's clear that Nagarjuna was conversant in many of the Nikaya school philosophies. Here, Nikaya, of course, meaning the early Buddhist schools, the 18 schools. Nikaya here doesn't mean the four Nikayas, as in Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, and so on. And with the emerging Mahayana tradition. However, affiliation to a specific Nikaya school is difficult, considering much of this material is present lost. If the most commonly accepted attribution of texts, that of Christian Linter, holds, then he was clearly a Mahayanist, but his philosophy holds assiduously to the non-Mahayana canon. And while he does make explicit references to Mahayana texts, he is always careful to stay within the parameters set out by the canon, that is to say, by the early Agamas. Nagarjuna may have arrived at his positions from a desire to achieve a consistent exegesis of the Buddha's doctrine as recorded in the canon. In the eyes of Nagarjuna, the Buddha was not merely a forerunner, but the very founder of the Madhyamaka system. David Kalapahana, who we'll be using as one of our basic texts, sees Nagarjuna as a successor to Moggaliputta in being a champion of the middle way and a reviver of the original philosophical ideals of the Buddha, Moggaliputta being the author of the Theravadan treatise, the Katawattu, probably composed around the time of Ashoka, that is about 400 years or so before Nagarjuna. This is part of Kalapahana's very interesting historical thesis. We don't have the book here where this is developed in detail. We have this. We have this book on Nagarjuna, but this other book is just called The History of Buddhist Philosophy or something. I'm not sure if it mentions it here. And in that book, he goes into some detail looking at different writers, including Moggaliputta, Nagarjuna, and various others, Dignaga, Vasubandhu, and others, and argues that they all represent positions which are coherent explanations of the teachings found in the early Agamas. And so, in other words, he develops an approach to Buddhist later Buddhist writers, rather than the normal way of looking at it, is to see this person belongs to this school and is expounding the doctrine of this school, and this person belongs to that school and is expounding the doctrine of that school. He looks at individual authors and individual texts and sees them as being in a kind of a dialectic, and within each school there may be people who are both agreeing and opposing the teachings found in the early canon. So that's a very interesting perspective on things. There exists a number of influential texts attributed to Nagarjuna, although most were probably written by later authors. The only work that all scholars agree is Nagarjuna's is the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which is what we'll be looking at later, which contains the essentials of his thought in 27 short chapters. So, it's very important to notice this, and this is of course a situation which has arisen because of the modern critical study of Nagarjuna. You have certain works attributed to him in Chinese, certain works attributed to him in Sanskrit, and it's very, in Tibetan, and others which, you know, it's difficult to find out who they belong to. And of course all the different lists of his works differ with each other. The works which are attributed to Nagarjuna differ very greatly, and they're very extensive, so it's unlikely that they were all composed by the same person. When we speak of Nagarjuna, then we're meaning the author of the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas. Okay, so Nagarjuna, as far as we're concerned, effectively is the author of the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. Okay, and the question then becomes: is the same person who wrote this book also the person who wrote those other books. And it's also argued whether there are more than one Nagarjuna, which of course there may well be more than one author or philosopher of that name. And as commonly you find in the ancient world that say, for example, works of a school or of a student may be attributed to the teacher as well. So there are substantial room for doubt as to which ones he actually wrote. If we look here, then of course we only have a fairly limited group of texts which are fairly widely agreed to be his by modern scholars, and in many of them you see are very short. The Shunyata Saptati is 70 verses on emptiness, and the Yukti Shastika 60 verses on reasoning. This particular one, Praticca Samuppada Hridaya Karika, is actually I have a copy of it here, and you can see that's not a particularly long philosophical work. Right, it's just one paragraph. So the actual works that are very likely to be Nagarjuna's are fairly limited, and it's usually understood that his major philosophical statement is the Mulamadhyamaka Karika. And so most discussions of Nagarjuna are in fact discussions of the Mulamadhyamaka Karika, and occasionally supplemented by other works. The Shurhaleka is quite a different kind of work. That's a letter, literally is a letter to a good friend, and is a sort of a kindly letter of advice to a king, rather than being a philosophical discussion. And those of you who came to the ABS conference in December saw the presentation by Drasko, who made a presentation arguing that some of the less well-known works of Nagarjuna point to quite a different philosophical position. So there are other works attributed to Nagarjuna, some of which may be genuine and some not. In particular, several important works of esoteric Buddhism, most notably the Panchakrama, or Five Stages, are attributed to Nagarjuna and his disciples. Contemporary research suggests that these works are datable to a significantly later period in Buddhist history, late 8th or early 9th century, but tradition of which they are a part maintains that they are the work of the Madhyamaka Nagarjuna and his school. Traditional historians, for example, the 17th century Tibetan Taranatha, whose history we have a copy of, a translation of, aware of the chronological difficulties involved, account for the anachronism by a variety of theories such as the propagation of later writings by mystical revelation. The useful summary of this tradition is literature and historiography, blah, blah, blah. In the Tibetan tradition, they regard Nagarjuna as one of the lineage holders, and if you look at the lineage lists, which gives the kind of the account of the transmission of the Dharma from the Buddha to Kassapa to Ananda and so on, then Nagarjuna is actually the lineage holder for a period of about 400 years, which doesn't sort of arouse too much confidence in the historicity of the tradition. The fact that he's in the Tibetan and some traditions regarded to have lived for 400 years or so on is attributed to his mastery of magics and so on. Linta considers that the Mahaprajñāparamitopadesa, a huge commentary on the large Prajñāparamita, not to be a genuine work of Nagarjuna. This is only extant in a Chinese translation by Kumara Jiva. Anyway, that's a different. Okay, so then it goes on to his philosophical discussion, which I will just look briefly at. Nagarjuna's primary contribution to Buddhist philosophy is in the use of shunyata, or emptiness, which brings together other key Buddhist doctrines, particularly anatman and pratityasamutpada, to refute the metaphysics of sarvastivada and satrantika. For Nagarjuna, as for the Buddha in the early texts, it's not merely sentient beings that are selfless or non-substantial. All phenomena are without any swabhava, literally own being or self-nature, and thus without any underlying essence. They are empty of being independently existence. Thus, the heterodox theories of Svabhava circulating at the time were refuted on the basis of the doctrines of early Buddhism. This is so because all things arise dependently, not by their own power, but depending on conditions leading to their coming into existence as opposed to being. Nagarjuna was also instrumental in the development of the two truths doctrine, which claims that there are two levels of truth in Buddhist teaching, one which is directly ultimately true and one which is only conventionally or instrumentally true, commonly called upaya in later Mahayana writings. That particular teaching is very commonly attributed to Nagarjuna, but the doctrine of the two truths is only found once in the whole of the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas, and when it is found, it has a decidedly ambiguous meaning. Kalapahana questioned seriously whether he actually held such a doctrine. It is also an Abhidhamma topic. Whether it was explicitly developed in Abhidhamma before Nagarjuna or not, I'm not sure. Yeah, it may or may not be. It's not found in the canonical Abhidhammas. It's found in the later Abhidhamma treaties. In terms of the historical evolution, I'm not sure. But certainly this is at least a popular understanding of Nagarjuna, that was one of his basic teachings, was on the distinction between the two truths. That's how he presented in popular Buddhism.
Possibly.
I'm not sure about that point. Yeah, certainly the doctrine is held in common. Whether he actually influenced or whether it came, I kind of suspect that it's most likely arose within the Sotavasivada, and that Nagarjuna, if he talked about it at all, reframed it, and the Theravadins adopted it from the Sotavasivadins. That would be my suspicion. Now this article then goes on to quote from the Kattayana Sutta, and this is extremely important because the Mula Madhyamaka Karika quotes or refers to the Kattayana Sutta, which is one of the most profound and interesting suttas found in the Nidana Samyutta, and it's often interpreted that Nagarjuna's philosophy is essentially an extension and an application of the teachings found in the Kachayana Sutta. By and large, Kachayana, this world is supported by a polarity or a duality, dualism, that of existence, atita, and non-existence, natita. But one reads the origination of the world as it actually, not reads, but when one perceives or discerns the origination of the world as it actually is with right discernment, non-existence, with reference to the world, does not occur to one. When one sees the cessation of the world as it actually is with right understanding, existence with the world does not occur to one. Okay, so the point here, but in this particular sutta, is this sutta only makes sense if we understand existence and non-existence as they were typically treated in Indian philosophy as implying eternal existence and the annihilation of things. So existence and non-existence is often explicitly identified with eternalism and annihilationism. And so the point here is the Buddha is giving a meditative strategy where remember this is from the suttas, not from Nagarjuna. If you have the idea of non-existence, okay, that is, if you have the idea that the world doesn't really exist, or that there's really nothing to the world, or that we're annihilated after death, and these kinds of nihilistic ideas, then one should contemplate the origination of the world, okay? So in other words, you contemplate the positive arising of causality, the positive side of dependent origination, and you see how one thing conditions another, and then you realize that, oh, the world can't just not be because there are conditions constantly producing things. Yeah? Do you see the point of that? How can the mind just disappear? We see the mind producing things all the time, and this constant origination of things. So how can it just be that everything just suddenly stops? So that's like a meditative strategy encoded in here. And then the opposite is true. If you believe in eternalism, then you just constantly contemplate the cessation of things. Yeah. So So these are two different approaches to Vipassana meditation, which are suitable for people from different backgrounds. Right? So if you get someone coming from an atheist background, who says, I don't believe in karma and rebirth and so on, you don't try to convince them and say karma and rebirth is true and so on. You say, oh, that's fine. You go away and you meditate on the arising of things. Okay? And you contemplate, you constantly watch the arising of things. And if somebody comes to you and says, after death we all go eternally to live in the bliss in the bosom of Abraham, so that's very nice. Now you go away and contemplate the cessation of things. Yeah? And so they contemplate cessation, cessation, cessation. By and large, Kajani, this world is in bondage to attachments, clingings and biases. But one such as this does not get involved with or cling to these attachments, clingings, fixations of awareness, biases or obsessions. Nor is he resolved on myself, attanameti. He has no uncertainty or doubt that just stress, obviously Venerable Tanisaro's translation here, nakankatina vichikichati, there's not uncertainty or doubt, dukkameva upajamanam upajati, dukkang nirujamanam nirujati. Suffering, what arises is just suffering arises, but suffering is just suffering ceasing. In this, his knowledge is independent of others, the parapachaya. It's to this extent, Kachayana, that there is right view. Everything exists. Sabang ati, that's one extreme. Everything does not exist, that is the second extreme. And it's crucial to understand that the phrase here, sabang ati, everything exists. This is precisely the name of the Sarvastivadin school, Sarvang Asti. Yeah, everything exists. That's the name of the school of Buddhism, which Nagarjuna is criticizing. Okay? So of course this is the reason why he's relying on this particular sutta, because it says straight in the middle of the sutta, those Sarvastivadins are teaching an extreme view. Of course the Sarvastivadins would say, well, we don't mean the same thing by Sarvangasti that's meant in this sutta by the same thing, okay? By that phrase. So they would argue about that, but this is the why he's using this sutra for his polemical purposes. Sabang nati, everything does not exist. That's the second extreme. So also to notice that this particular kind of phrasing is found very commonly in the Nidana Samyutta, where the Buddha is pointing to these kinds of things. So in other places, for example, he says, you know, the teaching that everything is eternal is one extreme, everything is annihilated is another extreme. Or he would say, everything is a unity. Sabang ekatam is one extreme. Everything is a diversity. Sabang nanatam. This is a second extreme. And then avoiding these two extremes, to target the teachers of Dhamma by the middle way, that is by dependent origination. So, Nagarjuna differentiates between conventionally and ultimately true teachings, but he never declares any conceptually formulated doctrines to fall into this latter category. Notice how this article, you know, reflecting modern studies of it, which reflects again the Tibetan and Chinese interpretations, which infects Nagarjuna's commentators and so on, place this conventional and ultimate thing repeatedly, and that they're asking you, the student, to read Nagarjuna through this doctrine, which they say is what Nagarjuna himself is doing. And when we have a look at the text, we'll find that Nagarjuna proceeds in a somewhat different way. For him, he never declares, yeah. That's right, yeah.
So he's trying to go through the attainments,
Yeah. Even emptiness is empty. The designable is ceased when the range of the designable nirvrittam, when the range of thought is ceased, for phenomenality is like nirvana, arisen and unarisen and unstopped. Phenomenality, by that's a phenomenality, it should be the nature of things. Is not arisen. Okay. So Nagarjuna also taught the idea of, so you see the tetralemma, which we've discussed earlier in the sutta context. It's not Nagarjuna's tetralemma, it's commonly found in the arguments. Nagarjuna also taught the idea of relativity. In the Ratnavali, he gives the example that shortness exists only in relation to the idea of length. The determination of a thing or object is only possible in relation to other things or objects, especially by way of contrast. He held that the relationship between ideas of short and long is not due to intrinsic nature, svabhava. Its idea is also found in the agamas, in which the idea of relativity is expressed similarly. That which in the element of light is seen to exist on account of darkness, that which is the element of good is seen to exist on account of bad, that which is the element of space is seen to exist on account of form. Okay, so this is a quote from the Dhatu Samyutta, I believe. I'm looking at the proper reference there, but I'm pretty sure that's from the Dhatu Samyutta. So it then goes on to tell some more about Nagarjuna as a Ayurvedic physician, as traditions claim, unlikely that it's the same person, and the iconography that is often depicted, of course, with the Naga, obviously from his name, and gives a list of the various works associated with him. So that's just a general introduction, a summary of Nagarjuna and his background.
Does his name have anything to do with where he was born?
Sorry?
Does his name have anything to do with where he was born?
Nagarjunakonda, most likely it was given that name sort of in memory of the fact that he was born there. Oh, you know, had a historical association with him. There was we had an excellent book called Nagarjuna in Context. Unfortunately, Venerable Sandidamo took that. It was his personal book. He took it with him when he left. And he looked much more at the historical questions surrounding where he lived and so on. One of the interesting things about Nagarjuna, apart from the fact that he's just a very challenging and interesting philosopher in his own right, is that he's been seen in modern times by several quite different philosophers as being somebody who negotiated a middle way between the different doctrines taught by the Mahayana and early Buddhist schools. And indeed, it's often interpreted that the name of his school, the Madhyamaka, middle way school, was chosen for that very reason. And that particular interpretation has been promoted by A.K. Warder, who's one of the greatest of the Western scholars of Buddhism, also by David Kalapahana, who's probably one of the greatest of the Sri Lankan scholar philosophers. And also by Master Yin Shun, who's the greatest modern Taiwanese philosopher of Buddhism. And Yin Shun came to a very, very similar perspective on Nagarjuna from quite an independent background. Warder, in quite an influential article published in, I think, the late 60s, asked the question, was Nagarjuna a Mahayanist? And that particular point of view was followed up by David Kalapahana, who argued that Nagarjuna was not a Mahayanist. The basis for that particular argument was simply that in the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, that there's basically no mention of Mahayana. That when he talks about the path of practice, he talks about the Eightfold Path, not about the stages of the Bodhisattva. He talks about becoming an Arahant, not about becoming a Bodhisattva or a Buddha and so on. And he's constantly referring back to doctrines and teachings found within early Buddhism rather than Mahayana teachings, and his textual references tend to be with the agamas rather than with Mahayana sutras. And so it was argued by these very, very eminent scholars that in fact he likely wasn't a Mahayanist at all. That particular point of view is no longer widely accepted, and other scholars have pointed out a couple of places in the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas which do in fact paraphrase sections of the Prajnaparamita Sutras and show at the very least that he was familiar with those doctrines and regarded them as in some sense canonical or worthy of citing. So it's now generally understood that he was a Mahayanist, but as it says here, that he tended to sort of stick as much as he could within the early canon, which suggests that he was trying to speak to a general audience. It doesn't really sort of change that perspective, that he was still trying to be a centering figure rather than sort of identifying strongly with a polemical vision of the Mahayana philosophy. the very fact that discussion or debate could have taken place is a suggestion on how little the reliance on Mahayana in fact was. Well, again, that's another very important question. Yeah, during that whole period, first, second, third, fourth centuries, there's very, very little epigraphical evidence for Mahayana in ancient India. So,
So how does his writing exist? You know, is it just Chinese translations?
There's Chinese translations, Tibetan translations, and Sanskrit originals. So the Sanskrit texts were recovered from Nepal, I believe, and or Tibet, but I think from Nepal in the 1920s and 30s by this Indian monk whose name escapes me right at the moment. So the Western scholars since then rely primarily on the Sanskrit text.
Isn't the one with the guy?
Drasko?
Yeah. Didn't he say that it was
found
in Afghanistan? Like that he was talking about?
That might have been a different text, I'm not sure. I think it might have been a different text. I believe that the Nagarjuna was found either in Nepal or...
No, I mean, he said it was a new find,
Yeah, it may be a new find. I think it might have been another...
That was found and he didn't
have to... I think it was if I remember rightly, it was a manuscript of the other Nagarjunian text which he was studying, not of the Mahamudra Karika.
Yeah, it wasn't this particular one. Yeah.
So that would be that. What I was going to say was that question about the extent of the Mahayana at the time is that the author in the book Nagarjuna in Context, whose author I can't remember at the moment, argues that Nagarjuna spent most of his time living in monasteries that belonged to the early schools of Buddhism, and that this was one of the reasons why he had to kind of negotiate his philosophy in a way that didn't kind of upset the early Buddhist schools too much. Right? So he had to be quite tactful in the way that he presented things. Not that he was actually all that tactful, but this argues that he kind of was trying to in a way, sort of present a perspective which had been developed in the Prajnaparamita and sort of show that that in fact wasn't the radical break from early Buddhism which could easily be interpreted. And one of the reasons for doing that also is that, in a sense, for a scholar at that time would have needed that institutional support even for things which we maybe take for granted, like say access to writing materials, which for a wandering monk wandering around India and so on, it's not necessarily that easy to get, and it's very expensive to get the parchment and the inks and these kinds of things, and also you have to have a library to store it in, right? So you have to have somebody who's favourable to you to actually want to put your book in a library and to keep it.
But also it can be founders. If you're a farmer or something, obviously you're not part of it because it's built on you. So
exactly, yeah.
You're a farmer, then obviously he's not.
Exactly, like Socrates or like Jesus or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Have a look. There's a nice article here on Nagarjuna's philosophy, which is actually in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And I'll just look very, very briefly at the first paragraph, which I don't want to spend too much time talking about him and not actually looking at his text, but this gives us a bit of a background to the notion of swabhava. And we have discussed this, but it's a subtle concept, so it's good just to go over it and see how what it means. So rather we're looking at the notion which Nagarjuna was criticizing. The central concept around which all of Nagarjuna's philosophy is built is the notion of emptiness, shunyata. Emptiness is of course always the emptiness of something, And the something Nagarjuna has in mind here is Swabhava. Different terms have been used to translate this word into English, inherent existence and intrinsic nature, or substance and essence. None of these cover the full complexity of the term. We therefore have to give more detailed account of the way Swabhava is characterized in Nagarjuna's thought. By understanding what empty things are supposed to be empty of, we simultaneously gain a more precise understanding of the concept of emptiness. We can distinguish two main conceptual dimensions of the concept of Swabhava, an ontological one, which refers to a particular way in which objects exist. Okay, so ontology is the study of existence, the philosophy of what it means to say something exists. And a cognitive one, which refers to the way in which objects are conceptualized by human beings. So it's more to do with epistemology. How do you know things? Within the ontological dimension, we can distinguish three different understandings of Swabhava in terms of essence, in terms of substance, and in terms of absolute reality. Even though this distinction is largely based on Madhyamaka authors later than Nagarjuna, it is still a useful heuristic tool for understanding the philosophical point he was trying to make. If we understand Swabhava, and one of the reasons for saying this, I have to say, is that Nagarjuna is an extraordinarily difficult and abstruse author who takes everything for granted and assumes that you already know the entire background of everything and just plunges straight into things, as we will see. So this is why it's useful to get this kind of background. If we understand Swabhava in terms of essence, it has to be considered a property an object could not lose without ceasing to be that very object. The Swabhava of fire is to be hot, the Swabhava of water to be wet. Whatever ceases to be hot is no longer fire, whatever ceases to be wet is no longer water. According to this understanding, Swabhava is also identified with the kind of specific qualities, Swalakshana, which allow an observer to distinguish an object from other things. By knowing that something is hot, together with a variety of other Swalakshanas, we know that what we have in front of us is fire rather than something else. It is important to note that this concept of Swabhava, which plays only a small role in Nagarjuna's writings but becomes more important in later Madhyamaka writers, is not the target of the Madhyamaka critique. When Nagarjuna argues that things are empty of Swabhava, it is not this notion of essence he is concerned with. The philosophically more important understanding of Swabhava is an understanding in terms of substance. Okay, so this is the first way of understanding this notion of Swabhava. It's an essence, something, a property an object could not lose without ceasing to be that very object. Okay, the hotness of fire and so on. And so this, according to this writer, is not the main target of Nagarjuna's critique. Second way of understanding Swabhava is in terms of substance. In Buddhist philosophical thought preceding Nagarjuna, and this is primarily referring to the Sarvastivadin school and similar teachings also found in the Theravadin Abhidhamma, the post-canonical Abhidhamma, we find the distinction between primary existence, dravyasat, and secondary existence, prajñaptisat. Primary existence, so this is the notion of dravya, or in Pali is dabba, and is meaning substance. Primary existence constitute the objective and irreducible constituents of the world out there, while secondary existence depend on our conceptual and linguistic practices. Some Buddhist schools would hold that only atomic moments of consciousness are really real, whereas everything else, including shoes and ships and sealing wax, is a mere aggregate of such moments constructed by our conceptualizing mind. This, of course, being the essential Abhidhamma doctrine, or the Abhidhamma doesn't hold that only consciousness is real. According to this theory, the entire world around us would be relegated to the status of mere secondary existence, apart from the moments of consciousness which are primary existence. In this context, Swabhava is equated with primary existence and denotes a specific ontological status. To exist with Swabhava means to be part of the basic furniture of the world, independent of anything else that also happens to exist. Such objects provide the ontological rock bottom on which the diverse world of phenomena rests. They provide the end point of a chain of ontological dependence relations. Okay, so what this is saying is it's very similar to say a 19th century conception of atoms, which is what most of us probably learnt in high school, okay, that there are these things called atoms, which are the kind of the smallest things in the universe, except of course the electrons and protons and neutrons, which actually make up the atoms, so they're not really the smallest things. And the electrons and protons and neutrons are kind of lumps of stuff which kind of move around and interact with each other, and everything else in the world is made up of these lumps of stuff. So that really, what we call a book or a cup or a table, is really just these atoms which, and these particles of atoms which are just lumps of stuff interacting with each other. And so this is a reductive argument, okay, which argues that the level of understanding of atoms is somehow more real than the understanding of tables, okay? So this is an argument which is known as reductionism, that somehow the understanding of things... Of course, in modern physics, that doesn't apply anymore, because in modern physics they realize that actually atoms themselves and the particles of atoms are not any kind of substance, and they're still kind of continually undermining and going to deeper and deeper layers, and there's no conclusion within physics itself, even that there is any ultimate level of building blocks of the universe, and if there is, what that might look like. Certainly, whatever it is, it's not lumps of stuff. So this is the late Abhidhamma doctrine, is basically the same kind of idea, that there are these lumps of stuff which make up the world in a physical and in a psychological sense. And those lumps of stuff are very much reduced from our own empirical perception of the world, which is one of the problems of it. For example, one of them is taste. Okay, so one of the ultimate constituents of the world, according to the Abhidhamma philosophy, one of these dravyasats, these ultimately existing things, is taste. Of course, now we would understand, you know, from as chemical and biological beings, that taste is actually a complex phenomena which happens at quite a high order in the kind of the structure or hierarchy of the way things are, you know, you need a brain and a tongue and all of these chemical interactions and so on to be able to discern taste. It's not a primary constituent of the universe. Whereas this is the Abhidhamma point of view. So this is the main teaching which Nagarjuna is criticizing.
So that was an early Buddhist philosophy.
Yes. Mainly the Sarvastivadins. They had a strong tendency to reify objects in this way. Nagarjuna argues, however, that there is no such end point. It is the understanding of Swabhava as a primary existent or substance that constitutes the main target of his philosophical criticism. Before we have a closer look at the form this criticism takes, we must briefly remember mention the final ontological understanding of Swabhava, namely Swabhava as absolute reality. If Swabhava is regarded as the true nature of phenomena, it is sometimes characterized as not being brought about by any causal process, as unchangeable and as independent of any other object. And remember, this is starting to remind us of some of the teachings of those earlier heretical teachers, remember? Yeah, the different bodies which remain and unchanged and unaffected. The interesting problem arising here is that for the Madhyamaka, the true nature of phenomena is emptiness, i.e. the absence of Swabhava understood as substance, and that Swabhava understood in this way is also characterized as not brought about by any causal process, as unchangeable and as independent of any other object. So it seems to be the case that something that has all of these properties must exist, since there is Swabhava, which is the true nature of phenomena, and must not exist, since the Madhyamaka argues Swabhava understood as substance does not exist. In the Buddhist commentarial literature, we find several different ways of dissolving this contradiction. One way of tackling the issue is by differentiating two senses in which Swabhava can be independent of any other object. This can be understood as a familiar understanding of substance as a primary existent noted above, but it can be also understood as meaning not dependent on any specific phenomenon. We could then argue that emptiness as the true nature of phenomena is to be understood as Swabhava and thus as independent only in the second but not in the first sense. This is due to the fact that Swabhava in the sense rejected by Madhyamaka thinkers is regarded as a superimposition mistakenly projected onto objects which in fact lack it. Thus, emptiness only exists as long as Swabhava understood as substance is mistakenly projected onto some object or another. Emptiness does not depend on any specific phenomenon to exist, but there has to be some phenomenon mistakenly conceived for emptiness to exist. Very curious kind of philosophical argument here. Emptiness is not some kind of primordial reality ante rem. Anyone?
Ante before.
Sorry?
Ante before.
Maybe for itself, existing for itself, in and of itself, but a corrective to a mistaken view of how the world exists. This account boils down to saying that there are really only two ways of understanding Sabhava as essence and as substance. What was earlier called Sabhava's absolute reality is only a specific form of Sabhava understood as essence. In the same way as heat is an essential quality of fire, emptiness is an essential quality of all phenomena. Things could not be the things they are without being empty. So that's quite a lucid presentation of some of the basic philosophical propositions. Don't worry about it. Okay, so here we have a translation. Unfortunately, this is a translation by Stephen Batchelor. Okay, so this is a translation of Nagarjuna, which is unfortunately by Stephen Batchelor. It's the only one I could find online. And I say I'm fortunate because he's translated it, as you can see, from the Tibetan, which is entirely improper from a scholarly point of view to translate from a translation when the original text actually exists. But I haven't got any translation of the original text.
Do you have the original text?
I have, yeah, and we have it online.
You can read copy.
I can, but a bit. But anyway, that's... This is a bit dense. I might switch over to the other one and look at that. It starts out with these first four lines are the dedicatory verses. This is Sanskrit, yeah. And it's written as many of the philosophical texts of the time. It's written in a verse form. Which obviously, in some ways, it's very demanding, extremely demanding and quite difficult form for philosophy. And it means, of course, you have to sort of stretch and squash your technical vocabulary to some degree. But also, this kind of thing is usually an indication that it was meant to be passed down in an oral tradition together with its commentary. Yeah, so Nagarjuna himself probably would have done that, and so on with the various teachers. Okay, so anirodha. What does that mean? Anirodha. Not cessation, not ceasing. Anutpada. Not arising. Yes, very good. Anucheda. Anucheda. Anyone got no ched? No. Ucheda, cut off. Yeah, not annihilated. Uchedavada is the doctrine of annihilation. Ashashvatam. No, different word. Not eternal. Okay, that's sasvata in Pali. Not eternal. Anekarta. No, it's a different word. Here's aneka, not one, artha, which here is translated as Pali, it's atta. Here is translated, can be translated many ways, non-identity, ananartha, so not many things, not diversity. Reminding of remember this is very close to the Nidana Samyutta itself, where it talks about, you know, Ucheda is one extreme and Sasata is another extreme. Oneness is one extreme And diversity is another strength. So he's clearly evoking. He expects you to know these canonical references, all right? And he expects you to get in this word that you immediately would know what he's talking about, okay? But he's also provoking you, as well as referring to, this is the way that he works, he's referring to standard doctrinal teachings, which he would assume that any student would know, and then again, but he's throwing in here at the beginning these very challenging things and saying that arising and cessation are along the same lines as impermanence, as annihilation and permanence and so on. Anartha, anagama, nirgama. So not coming and not going. What is dependent origination? The stilling, the upasama of prapancha, of conceptual proliferation, shivam, the stillness or the auspicious, Shiva, this being of course the name of the god Shiva. Deshamanasa sambuddhasam, is taught by is taught by that sambuddha, I bow down and pay respects to that excellent Buddha who's taught these doctrines. So this is the dedicatory verse. Okay? So already he's kind of thrown out this thing, and it's a very provocative way of writing. It's why I love the way that Nagarjuna does things. You know, he's doing this kind of devotional verse to the Buddha, where he's sort of dedicating and bowing down to him, and he's mentioning all of these, you know, quite profound teachings from the early canon, and then throws in his own kind of particular interpretation, and he's also paying homage to the Buddha because of this. Now there are a number of ways of interpreting this particular verse, and say two main ways of interpreting this verse, which reflect the two main ways that the Nagarjuna has been interpreted by the tradition. Okay, one way of interpreting the verse is to treat these doctrines, and especially the doctrine of dependent origination, right, on the same level or the same plane as these first two lines. And this is, I believe, the interpretation of Chandrakirti, who is Nagarjuna's main commentator within the one school of the Madhyamaka. So one way of looking at it is to say that Nagarjuna was teaching basically the escape from all of these things, including the escape from dependent origination. Alright? And that these terms here, when he was referring to a non-arising, non-ceasing, and so on, that he was actually referring to dependent origination. So this is one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it, that would be what was called the prasangika interpretation, which is essentially arguing that Nagarjuna only has a negative argument to put. The whole essence of what he's doing is to criticize and to get rid of false conceptions and not to make any positive philosophical propositions himself. That's the prasangika interpretation, which is the dominant one in Tibetan Buddhism. The other way of looking at it, which they call the swatantrika interpretation, holds that Nagarjuna, as well as criticizing doctrines, also made his own positive assertions. And so when looked at from that perspective, then these first two lines would be his criticism of various kinds of sectarian tenets and sectarian viewpoints. And then these last two lines is where he's referring to the actual doctrines that the Buddha teaches, that is dependent origination and the Nibbana as the ending of prapancha and the ending of proliferation. And of course, specifically noting that aspect when he talks about prapancha or pasamang is just a word for nibbana, but it's specifically a word for nibbana which implies the ending of that kind of theorizing mind, which has resulted, of course, in all of these wrong conceptions. All right, so it's very kind of tightly worded.
So the first two lines.
Yeah.
He's
not saying it's a heap of rubbish. He's just saying that there's not these things. There's not no ceasing, no arising, none, and so on and so forth.
But so, what other schools of
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Remembering that when he's saying that everything should be interpreted through that notion of swabhava, okay, so when he's saying arising and ceasing, he's meaning arising and ceasing of swabhavas, of things that exist inherently in and of themselves. Yeah? So this is why these verses are very challenging from a traditional Buddhist point of view. And if you want to read things literally and so on, you'll end up with the Theravadan approach. And so there's a lovely footnote here. And this is from the Visuddhimagga, and particularly from the commentary to the Visuddhimagga, which is written maybe 6th century, probably a couple of hundred years after Nagarjuna. And it says here, blah, blah, blah. Some misinterpret the meaning of dependent origination thus, without cessation, without arising, which is anupadang anirodham, which of course is almost identical to the first few lines, first phrase here, instead of taking the unequivocal meaning in the way stated. Okay, so instead of interpreting the text literally, it's talking about arising and cessation. And of course, that's the sub-commentator on the Visuddhimagga referring to Nagarjuna's work, one of the rare citations of Nagarjuna in the Theravadan scriptures. So clearly they didn't believe him. So here we go. This is the first four lines of his text. I'm just going to switch over to another Sanskrit text here, because this one, as you can see, he hasn't broken it up, so it's a bit dense. This one's a bit nicer laid out. It's the same text. Na svato napi parato na dvabhyang napi ahetuta. Utpanna jatu vidyante bhavha kva chana ke chana. Okay, who wants to translate that? No? Anyone? Na is no. Excellent. Thank you. Na? Napi is also not. Excellent. That's good. See, it's not so hard for that. No swatos and paratos. Excellent. That's good. So we're getting some of the grammar here. Huh? No, that's good.
And
so
also
what's
no.
And so what's swato? What's swa? We've already had this. We've been talking about it before. Swabhava. No. Bhava is existing. Swa is what? Intrinsic or oneself, yeah? Swa, belonging to oneself, yeah? Swato, this is an ablative form, like it means, it's, and this is used commonly in the context of causality, it means from oneself. Not from oneself, not para, from another. Excellent. Okay, see, it's not as hard as that. Okay, from dvabhyam. Okay, what does that mean? Notice it, dwa, English two. What does dwabhyam mean? Two things? Not from both. Yeah? Not from both. So not from oneself, from itself, not from another, not from both. And also napi, so this is the same as this napi. Ahetuta. Ahetu? What's hetu? Cause, no cause. So things are not arisen from themselves, not from oneself, not from itself, not from another, not from both, and not from, but with no cause.
Not
a cause, yeah. Not with not, any things are not arisen by chance. Yeah? Yeah? Utpana jatu vijyante bhava kvachana kechana. No existence whatsoever are evident anywhere. Okay, so just utpanna is arisen, jatu is to be born, I believe. Vijyante is, you find this is a word that's used constantly through here. If I see this down here, vijyante, it means to be evident. Literally is to be known. Vijyati in Pali. Bhava is an existent. So this is the second part of the word swabhava. Okay, so bhava. Kvachana kechana, that means whatsoever, wherever. Okay?
The first
Utpanna jatu vijante. There's no not arisen anywhere. There's not arisen any existent anywhere whatsoever. Something like that. So no existence are evident anywhere that are arisen from themselves, from another, from both, or from a non-cause. Jatu, no existence whatsoever are evident anywhere that are arisen. I'm not quite sure of how to construe that jatu there. Upana is arisen. I'm not quite sure it's from the word jati. This is the word existent. Possibly just repeating upana. I'm not quite sure what that is. So kvachana and kechana is just exactly equivalent to the English whatever. Okay? So this is Nagarjuna's style. He just sort of comes out and just sort of, there you go. There's nothing, whatever, nothing existent anywhere that's arisen from itself or arisen from somewhere else or arisen from both or not arisen from a cause. So he's immediately kind of, just in his first two lines, he's kind of swept out the whole kind of basis, apparently, of Buddhist philosophy, which of course has all been about understanding causality and the notion of causes and so on and so forth. He just comes and get rid of that in two lines, right? From another, yeah. From another. Something like that, yeah.
But he didn't say without cause. He said actually things are not without cause, so that there is cause and effect.
He didn't say that there is cause and effect. He's saying that there's no existence anywhere, like no existing things. In the sense we talked about earlier, there's no things that substantially exist in and of themselves that have arisen either from themselves, from another, from both, or without a cause.
Yeah, but what I'm hearing is what he's saying is not against dependent origination.
Well, that's what he would say. Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Sure. Okay.
Because it's not without a cause. So basically, what is left is things only arise if there is a cause for them to.
And is that cause? What is that cause? Is that cause themselves or something else?
No, he doesn't say.
But what do you think?
I don't. Of many cells.
Oh, terrific! That's really solving the problem there. Multiply the fallacy. It's always a good one. Okay, so there's the first one. He comes out. Now the second one. He then says something quite different. There's something quite different in the next one. So you see, you know, but that thing, there's a very revealing remark you just said there. You said you don't think. Actually, historically, Nagarjuna's philosophy developed stage by stage into what's known as the Koan school in Japanese Zen, where they use sort of Nagarjunian style paradoxes precisely in order to get you to stop thinking. Yeah? And so they're using.
So
Okay. Now, second verse here. There are four conditions. Okay. Now, this is referring to the classical Abhidhamma doctrine, which enumerated various lists of conditions. Okay. What they call pachaya. Of course, in the suttas, it talks about pachaya all the time. But the Abhidhamma sort of wanted to systematize that list of prachayas. And here he's stating a teaching of four prachayas, which I believe is the Sarvastivadin teaching. I may be incorrect on that. The Theravadins, of course, developed that much further and have 24 conditions. Okay, so here he's stating there are four conditions. Hetu is the first kind of condition. Hetu pachayo, aramana pachayo. So if you're familiar with the Theravadin list of pachayas, you recognize that these are all found there, together with a whole bunch of others. First one is Hetu pachaya. Second one, Aramana pachaya. I'll come back to that in a minute. Anantara pachaya. Anantaram. No, so Hetu is cause. Aramana is of support. Anantara is immediate. And Adipati is the last one. Adipati pachaya. Is predominance condition. Nasti panchama. There is no fifth. Yeah, but here it just, but it's not referring specifically to that doctrine here, it just means there's no fifth. So there's four conditions and there's no fifth.
Why does he have to say?
Maybe he's in a bad mood that day. No, here he's taking a stand on a particular teaching on the four pratyas. Now, of course, this again relates to that dispute in the way of interpreting. I mean, certainly from a straightforward reading of it, he's simply giving a teaching on four kinds of conditions. He's not saying that, you know, there are no conditions, but saying
so
that...
So here the conditions refer to the conditions
of in here? Mm. Yeah, exactly. So just very briefly, Hetu Patria is the root condition. It's in the Theravada. It's often explained as the greed, hatred, and delusion, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, being the roots of samsara, is the Hetu Patria. Okay, that's the Theravadan explanation. I'm not sure whether it's a Sarvasivadan explanation, but I'm just having a look at...
Is this kind of Theravada commentary? Is this from the Avatam?
No, this is Nagarjuna.
No, no, the understanding of it.
Hetu. It would be taken from a Abhidhamma of an early school, which I believe is the Sarvasivadins. I believe it's Sarvasivadins. And similar. Basically, the Theravadin took this early, this would be an early version of that theory, and the Theravadins greatly elaborated it. According to the Theravadins, ahead to Pachaya is the greed, hatred, and delusion, non-greed, hatred, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. Aramana is the sense objects as conditions for their appropriate sense consciousness. Anantara, just trying to remember what anantara pachaya is. Anantara pachaya means immediate, but essentially it means things that are arisen without any interval or gap in time. And it's something that's mentioned a few times in the suttas. So there's no interval or no gap. I can't remember the specific examples of that condition that's given. And adipati pachaya is predominance. So any quality which is predominant in producing its result, and the main example of that that's given in the Theravadan scriptures is the four idipadas as being predominant conditions. Okay, so this is our basic teaching on the conditions. So again, this is subject to interpretation. As to whether Nagarjuna is accepting, he seems to be accepting this doctrine, but is sometimes interpreted as being refuting them. Okay, so then we come to a rather more characteristic phrase of Nagarjuna. Nahi swabhavo bhavanang pratyayadishu vidyate, avidyamane swabhave parabhavo na vidyate. So, who wants to translate? By which you mean?
No.
Ah, excellent. First word. He? He? Yeah, means no. Nahi means no. Swabhava, yeah? In its own inherent existence. Okay, and bhavanam, bhava existent again, this is genitive plural. Pratyayadishu vidyate, pratyaya is the conditions, adishu, not quite sure that is, that's it, etc., conditions, etc., vidyate, vidyate is known or is evident. Okay, and when sabhava is not avidyamane in the non-evidence of sabhava inherent existence, then other existence is also not evident. Just to read the whole translation of the verse: the self nature, the sabhava of existence, is not evident in the conditions, etc. In the absence of self-nature, other nature too is not evident. Okay? So what this is arguing is that if you know the conditions of something, okay, then you can't tell just from the conditions of something. There's no way of knowing what the actual any kind of inherent essence of something is just from the conditions that have produced it. Okay, so just to give a simple example, if you're making fire, I can say, well, the conditions for fire are rubbing two sticks of wood together, the presence of oxygen and energy, and so on and so forth. But you can't tell just from accumulating and gathering all of those conditions together, you can't tell what fire is like. Okay, so the essential existence of the fact that fire has a swabhava, an inherent existence, can't be inferred from the conditions that give rise to something. And when there's no swabhava to be known, then you can't know when there's no self-existence, then there can be no other existence. So here he's giving an argument to refute these notions of self-existence and other existence. If all we know is the conditions for something, we can't conclude from that what it is itself. And if we don't know what it is itself, we can't define other. Obviously, you can't define other if you don't define self. And this refers back to the point that was made earlier, that Nagarjuna relies a lot on relativistic arguments. Okay, so you can't know long without knowing short, and so on. So here he's saying you can't know darkness without knowing light. So here he's saying if you don't know the self-existent, then you can't know the other existent. Okay, so this is very typical of the kind of arguments that Nagarjuna uses. Well, he's saying you can't know Sobhava. He's not saying you can't know anything.
Well, if you say you can't know long if you don't know short, but he's saying if you can't know if you don't know
Then
you don't know anything else. But you don't know Sobhava because there is no Sobhava, so you don't
know anything else. Well, no, you don't know the Parabhava. Again, just be careful to limit it to what he's actually saying. He's saying that because you can't see yourself, if you can't see yourself, that's the second line. If you can't see the self-existent, then you don't know the other existent.
Yeah, but you can't see yourself. He says that you can't see yourself, so that means you can't see the other.
Yeah.
But you can't see
it. No, you can't see these particular things that he's talking about. Yeah, Sobhava and Parabhava. He's not making general statements on the knowability or otherwise of things in general, but only of those specific things that he's critiquing. Yeah? Okay. So to the next verse, which is a slightly more difficult one. Kriya na pratyayavati. Na pratyaya vati kriya. So action, kriya, is not constituted of conditions or possessed of conditions, and kriya, action, is not non-constituted of conditions. Conditions are neither constituted nor non-constituted of activity. All right? Does that make sense? Sorry? Yeah, it's a good question. It's probably a technical term. Kanapahana's commentary here gives a couple of possible meanings for it. But activity, in one way he's giving an argument which is very similar to the previous verse, but instead he applied to activity rather than to inherent existence. So you can't identify the activity with the conditions or being separate from it. Conditions are neither constituted nor non-constituted of activity. So the idea here is, according to Kalpahana's comment here, kriya can refer to an inherent activity, a power or potentiality, a shakti, in something to produce an effect. Activity would then be an embodiment of a condition, or a condition that would be an embodiment of an activity. In either case, the activity or the condition is said to produce the effect. So this is the substantialist interpretation of causation. Okay, so the activity is something which ultimately exists, which is the condition. Okay, for something, and so Nagarjuna is essentially denying again that same notion. Of course, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly, yeah. And of course, this is one of the questions about it. I mean, you see, in a sense, you know, you can say, well, if he's refuting, you know, Sarvastivadin notions, then why bother? Because we don't even know what the Sarvastivadin notions are. But the point is that they're not just Sarvastivadin notions. They're actually expressions of the way that people tend to think. And that sort of, he would say, traps of thought that we tend to get caught into. So the point of this is to stop us from looking at things in kind of lazy ways where we think. See, the problem is that we think, or the Abhidhammikas would think that they've sort of captured the essence of these things, the emptiness and not self and so on. But in fact, in doing so and in pinning them down very tightly, Nagarjuna is alleging that they've fallen into the very kind of mistake which they've were trying to escape in the first place. And so this is why there's always this necessity in philosophy to have these sort of critical philosophers who come and always kind of untying the things which were done earlier. In any case, we've kind of run out of time because we're going to be doing a posita today. So let's leave it at that. And we'll have a bit more of a look at this next week. The Karikas, it's about 700 verses or something, 500 verses? No, it's not 500 verses. That's about as long as the Dhammapada or something, it's not very long. Yeah. It's not very long. It's a short treatise. It's a very short treatise.
Also, it's amazing that with such a short kind of thing,
you can
influence
it. Absolutely.
And it's in the English
somewhere,
is it?
Yeah, if you want to read the.
But I don't know. But I would like to read
this book, because
his explanation of what I asked
is
made it 10 times more
confusing. Hmm. For me. Yeah, but this has a good literal translation in it. So that's probably good. There's another book downstairs which also has a translation. So, but also, you know, you can see from the way that Nagarjuna argues that he is very open to different interpretations, and this has been the case ever since his own time, and still is the case today among the modern scholars of Nagarjuna. And there's a lot of debate, which, in a sense, is probably Nagarjuna would see a sign that he's been successful. You know, he's stimulating people to try to look in Dhamma more deeply and try to abandon the kind of lazy ways of thinking about things. So that's the job of a good philosopher, always to be challenging. Okay.
So the Hans Sutta is actually kind of added after all this initial work?
But no, the Hans Sutta is added after the longer Prajnaparamita Sutras. Mm-hmm. So it's a summary of the longer Prajnaparamita. Not entirely clear where it would be in relation to Nagarjuna. It may be earlier or later. Yeah. This is almost certainly later than the long Prajnaparamita Sutra, the original Prajnaparamita Sutra, but it's not sure how it's related to the Heart Sutra.
What's the age?
Yeah, that's a specific Sanskrit. H, I'm not entirely sure how it's supposed to be pronounced.
It's only quite a century.
Not in Pali, no, and it's used for endings of words and some endings in Pali, in Sanskrit. Okay, let's finish my poem this week.